Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, May 13th, 2025. We begin on the first page with Overcoming Barriers and Stigma, How Local Nonprofits Work to Improve Mental Health Access. This is by Olivia Jacobs. When Luella and Don Mahana set out to open Integrity Counseling in 2014, they didn't realize some of the same mental health barriers outlined in McLean County's Behavior Health Action Plan and Community Health Improvement Plan would still exist today, but they aimed to be part of the solution. Integrity, a pay-as-you-can mental health service for those who are uninsured or underinsured, is one of several nonprofit organizations in McLean County working to support community members' mental health needs for little to no cost. Integrity's mission is to provide stigma-free mental health support for all. Luella Mahana, who has a master's degree in counseling psychology, said when she was a volunteer at Home Sweet Home Ministries, she saw firsthand how difficult it was for people to receive counseling, even with insurance. People were waiting months to receive care, which inspired her to take action. The Mahanas recalled seeing former McLean County Sheriff Mike Emery speak on the news during that time about how the local jail had become a significant provider of behavioral health care because community members couldn't help elsewhere and were often ending up in jail. A lot of what our impetus has been trying to help people not slide into the justice system. Stop that before. And also, we see lots of people, clients, who are on the edges of poverty, Don Mahana said. A lot of times, people have insurance, but they can't use it because the deductible is $5,000 and they're choosing between groceries and counseling. And so we're trying to be that gap filler, being able to help people who wouldn't otherwise get care. Their clients range from university students to those in other transitional periods of life, facing divorce, child issues, in between employment, and more. They range in age, income, and gender. Some clients may pay nothing, while others may pay $50 per session, depending on what they can afford. Integrity uses private donations and grants to help offset the costs, which they are always in need of to help further their services. Integrity currently has 2 full-time counselors and 1 part-time, as well as various volunteer counselors, with an active caseload of about 180 clients. They are always looking for more volunteers and interns, too, to help alleviate their wait list, which is only about 2 to 3 people currently. Luella Mahana said they are taking on new clients. If someone calls in need of care, they are asked questions regarding income, insurance, whether they have tried to use insurance elsewhere, and other topics. Once they have completed an intake appointment, new clients will be assigned a long-term counselor. I think the model Integrity has could be replicated. I think other people could do what we're doing. It's a challenging thing to do, but I think that neighbors helping neighbors is a wonderful thing, and there are lots of resources, Don Mahana said, of how we can further improve mental health resources locally. Our process is unique, if you will, and we have a great partnership with other providers who will refer to us and we'll refer back to them when it makes sense. So we try to be part of the fabric of behavioral health. Another local nonprofit organization working to remove financial barriers for those in need of mental health services is the YWCA Stepping Stones Program, the Sexual Assault Service Center for all of McLean County, which offers free services to assault survivors. YWCA has 5 full-time counselors and 1 part-time counselor, with about 224 clients as of the end of March. They also have a 24-hour and year-round hotline people can call at 309-556-7000. Program Director Jen Galladay said Stepping Stones is accepting new clients and the counselors are actively working through their wait list. Stepping Stones offers interim support for clients as they wait for long-term counselor for a long-term counselor through advocacy services, including helping a client while they're in the hospital, filing criminal charges or civil no-contact orders, connecting them with others who can offer additional support, informing them of their options, and other general advocacy. There's a lot of survivors who can't afford therapy and might already be facing economic struggle. Having an acceptable pathway to healing is just vital to the survivors themselves, their families, and their community, Galladay said. I've gotten to see the impact on a day-to-day basis. It's almost hard to put into words. A lot of the feedback we've gotten is we're irreplaceable. With Stepping Stones, you're not having to walk this journey alone, and you can't put a measure on that. Additionally, YWCA offers prevention education for K-12 schools and at the college level to educate students on healthy relationships, how to listen to their bodies, learning to say no, ultimately trying to get ahead and prevent sexual violence before it occurs, and what that can look like, Galladay said. It doesn't matter when the assault occurred in your life, you are able to get services. Whether it was yesterday or 20 years ago, that has no bearing on whether you can get help, she said. One Hope Project, a mental health resource focused on eating disorder treatment, also offers low-cost care, including a sliding scale for services. Executive Director Hillary Paca started the Bloomington-based nonprofit in 2020, having worked in the nonprofit field for more than 20 years. She said each client answers a question about their income range as part of the intake process. One Hope then provides a recommended rate per session and asks the client what they can afford. So if, for example, it suggests $50, but the client can afford $30, they'll pay $30, Paca said, noting One Hope has had clients pay as little as $5 per session. She said in her early work she met clients who were struggling with an eating disorder or body image issues, but there wasn't a place to refer them unless they were seeking inpatient treatment at a hospital, which can be expensive and is usually a last resort. This stuck with her over the years, especially as she found herself struggling with food addiction and body image issues of her own. Her heart was in nonprofits, so she didn't want finances to be a barrier to someone in need of help, she said. One Hope has 5 counselors, including eating disorder specialists and registered dietitians, who offer nutritional counseling and basic case management, as eating disorders usually don't exist on their own. They also offer adult and teen support groups, and Paca said they plan to bring their evidence-based research, curriculum, and prevention education into local schools. One Hope Project currently has 42 active clients with a small wait list. They are currently training additional specialists. People don't realize that eating disorders are a mental health concern, Paca said. Eating disorders, you know, they don't exist on their own, so there's always a co-occurring mental illness, whether that's anxiety, depression, some kind of trauma. So it's like, of course we need to work on the depression and anxiety, but then underlying there is the eating disorder. Paca said eating disorders have the second highest mortality rate of mental illnesses behind opioid addiction, with someone dying every 52 minutes, yet it receives less than 1% of federal funding. According to the National Eating Disorders Association, approximately 20 million women and 10 million men will experience an eating disorder in their lifetime. And Paca said the people suffering from eating disorders in McLean County could fill CEFQ Arena 1.5 times. One Hope is always looking for more registered dietitians and volunteers to become eating disorder specialists to avoid a long wait list. The organization offers specialist training, as experience is not required. Randy Mass of Bloomington, a client of One Hope since 2023, said raising 6 kids and college bills were a barrier to affording one-on-one counseling to help with her struggles with food addiction and emotional eating. I don't know how many times I asked the doctors and I said, I know I have a food addiction. Is there a nutritionist in town? Somewhere I can go? She said. Usually, the response she received was along the lines of simply, eat less, move more. By chance, she learned about One Hope through a volunteer, and I go, oh, I think I need that, Mass said. Mass said it's been exciting to see her health changes, including no longer being considered pre-diabetic. It's been life-changing, and just the tools they give you to make progress, I can't imagine life without One Hope. Paca said one of her favorite things she ever heard from a client was, "You know, after working with you and all kind of getting to know that place I needed, I now know why you call it One Hope. For the first time, I actually have hope." In more local news, we have one treated, two displaced in house fire by Brendan Dennison. A Bloomington firefighter was treated for heat exhaustion, and two residents were displaced after a Saturday morning house fire, officials said. According to a statement from the Bloomington Fire Department, crews were called at 11:32 a.m. Saturday to a fire on the outside of a home at 707 East Grove Street. They arrived to find smoke spread through the interior. Crews immediately started working down the blaze as they searched the building, the statement said, as early reports indicated occupants may be trapped. BFD soon confirmed that all occupants were accounted for and no civilians were hurt. The department called in extra manpower due to the nature of the fire. Firefighters then worked the scene for several hours to overhaul the attic for obscured fire, the statement continued. Damage was concentrated to the back of the building, impacting each floor up and into the attic. Additional evaluations of the structure are pending. No cause has been identified by late Sunday afternoon. Investigators also found that several smoke alarms were without batteries and hoarding conditions seriously increase risk to occupants and firefighters. This incident is a powerful reminder about the importance of fire safety, said Captain Frank C. Friend, Public Information Officer for BFD. When a smoke alarm sounds, you have less than 3 minutes to get out safely. The American Red Cross was contacted to support displaced residents, the statement continued. The Bloomington Police Department, Nicor Gas, and Ameren Illinois also assisted at the scene. Caitlin Klepek writes, NPD enacting Click It or Ticket campaign. The Normal Police Department is enacting the Click It or Ticket campaign for Memorial Day. The enforcement, which will run from May 16th to May 27th, is funded with the Federal Highway Safety Funds administered by the Illinois Department of Transportation. According to a news release from the NPD, the Illinois Seat Belt Law was enacted 40 years ago on July 1, 1985, making Illinois the third state to require seatbelt use for drivers and front seat passengers age 8 and older, while children under 8 were required to be secured in child safety seats. In July 2003, the law was strengthened to allow officers to pull over and ticket drivers for failing to buckle up. Since the introduction and upgrade of the law, seatbelt usage surged from 15.9% in 1985 to 92.4% in 2004. Illinois had a 92.4% rate daytime seatbelt usage in 2024, but Normal Police said the key focus of this campaign is nighttime enforcement, as crash data indicates higher rates of unrestrained fatalities at night. In 2023, 72% of male passenger vehicle occupants killed in crashes were unrestrained, while 28% of females were killed unrestrained, according to the Normal Police Department. For more information on safe driving practices, visit itsnotagameillinois.com. Two schools announced their prom royalty. Tackett and Miller named prom king and queen. Olympia High School prom was held Saturday, May 3rd, at the Chateau Hotel and Conference Center in Bloomington. The prom king and queen were Ian Tackett of McLean and Mallory Miller of Danvers. In addition to Tackett and Miller, the prom court included Ella Evans, Tyler Dabney, Lydia Rutledge, Cooper Kleinschmidt, Cohen Alexander, Grace Berkey, Dylan Eimer, and Raquel Berkey. Also at Lexington High School, prom royalty crowns Hedrick and Stover. Lexington High School prom was held Saturday, May 3rd in the Davis Lodge at Lake Bloomington. The prom queen and king were Presley Hedrick and Judson Stover. The prom court also included Morgan Jurgelas, Josie Thomas, Vivian Wright, Anthony Walensky, Nate Steffen, and Misha Kaufman. The crown presenters were Audrey Miller and Cal Leek. Olivia Jacob writes, Duquoin State Fair, Little River Band performing August 24th. The Australian rock band, Little River Band, will headline the Duquoin State Fair Grandstand on Sunday, August 24th. Founded in Australia in 1975, the band enjoyed commercial success in its native country and the United States, selling over 30 million records. Its lineup has changed over the years, but the band remains known for hits including Lady, Reminiscing, Take It Easy on Me, Cool Change, and Lonesome Loser, among others. Tickets go on sale at 10 a.m. on Friday, May 16th, via Ticketmaster. The Duquoin State Fair runs August 22nd to September 1st. Other acts announced so far include David Lee Roth on August 23rd, Tesla on August 28th, Jake Owen on August 29th, and Gabby Barrett on September 1st, with more to be announced. Visit dsf.illinois.gov for more information. Next, from the front page with Adriana Perez of the Chicago Tribune, we have Federal Cuts Worry Weather Hobbyists. Melanie Snow and her husband talk about the weather like it's gossip. Every day they read National Weather Service discussions, technical documents from the agency where meteorologists explain the reasoning and rationale behind forecasts from weather events in Chicago and across the country. We avidly consume those, Snow said, and we're definitely the people in our circle of friends who, if they really want to know the weather for their vacation, wedding, birthday party, outing outside, etc., they call us and say, give me the lowdown. The couple met in college at Georgia Tech, where they both studied to become meteorologists. Then they didn't. She became a science educator and he became an actuary, but the weather bug stuck with them. Now, weather hobbyists and enthusiasts, some like Snow and her husband, who might prefer to watch storm clouds from the safety of their porch, and others who'd rather chase severe weather for the thrill, are feeling anxious about what federal funding and staffing cuts under the Trump administration could mean for the data they rely on daily from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and its National Weather Service. The back and forth on staffing has put the agency, like many others, in a state of limbo. Thousands of probationary employees were fired in mid-February, ordered by a federal judge to be rehired a month later, and then put on administrative leave, only to see the U.S. Supreme Court block that rehire order last month. Staff shortages have also temporarily suspended and reduced weather balloon releases that track temperature, pressure, and wind speed in the Great Plains and Midwest. Between recent buyouts and mass firings, nearly half of National Weather Service forecast offices had 20% vacancy rates as of April, and 8 of 122 offices are missing more than 35% of their staff. A lot of people don't know what goes into making a daily weather report that they access on their app. There are thousands of NOAA and National Weather Service people who are launching weather balloons every day and analyzing that data, Snow said. Weather forecasting has come so far, especially in the last 20 years. And to see that decline because of underfunding and firing the people at these organizations is really only harmful to everyone, not just enthusiasts. While Snow and her husband avidly follow the weather forecasts, a hearty contingent of Illinois storm chasers endeavor to get up close and personal. They are concerned not only about a loss of information, but also safety, theirs and those in the path of destructive storms. There's a lot of chatter about what could happen, a lot of worry. We rely on an enormous amount of data that's put out by the federal government in order to do what we do, said Skip Talbot, a storm chaser from Springfield. and vice versa. Most storm chasers have a regular full-time job, said Talbot, who is a software developer, but has traveled 250,000 miles to document 150 tornadoes over the past 20 years. We actually do try to make contributions to scientific research as much as we can, and it's really nice to be helpful out there. Make your passion useful, he said. Growing up in Oak Brook, Talbot's fascination was sparked by the strongest August tornado on record in the United States, which occurred in nearby Plainfield in 1990. The tornado, unusual and violent, took the lives of 29 people, injured 350, and caused an estimated $160 million in damages. In college, Talbot took some meteorology courses and received training in spotting and reporting hazards. The Weather Service relies on storm chasers to be their eyes out on the field, he said, as they can't see everything with radar. On the ground, chasers also use information from the agency. For instance, official tornado warnings can help chasers decide where to go when they're already out. If there aren't enough meteorologists to work every storm, then we're not going to get that kind of heads up. Likewise, we see a lot of stuff when we're chasing that the Weather Service just doesn't know about, he said. Weather Service offices often don't have the bandwidth to track down every weathered hazard, Talbot said. He has experienced this firsthand when he reports a tornado and the local office is too busy or understaffed to investigate. If there's less staff, he said, nothing will happen with that. So the log will be incorrect. There'll be errors in the storm data. We're already seeing some of that. Storm chasers and the public could be at risk if the Weather Service offers fewer frequent updates and safety warnings. The same could happen if there are limits on public access to NOAA's high-resolution radar system that detects and analyzes weather, as well as its satellite data on temperature, moisture, cloud cover, and more. As extreme weather events intensify because of climate change, from human greenhouse gas emissions, past and current data will only become more critical. In the Midwest, as the climate gets warmer and the atmosphere holds more humidity, severe storms are expected to become more frequent. I can't tell you it's going to cause such and such number of deaths, but I can tell you, you start removing people from these posts and start taking data away, yes, inevitably somebody is going to die because of that, Talbot said. According to a New York Times report, five former Weather Service directors signed an open letter May 2nd, warning that cuts to the organization by the Trump administration may endanger lives. The letter notes that the coming weeks are expected to be especially busy for severe weather. Airplanes can't fly without weather observations and forecasts. Ships crossing the oceans rely on storm forecasts to avoid the high seas. Farmers rely on seasonal forecasts to plant and harvest their crops, which feed us. Perhaps most importantly, the NWS issues all of the tornado warnings, hurricane warnings, flood warnings, extreme wildfire conditions, and other information during extreme weather events. And in agriculture news, we have Less Farmland Going Organic by Caitlin DeProza and Patrick Whittle with the Rochester Institute of Technology and the Associated Press. Farmer Jeremy Brown taps the nose of a young calf. I love the ones with the pink noses, he says. This pink-nosed animal is just one of about 3,200 cattle at Twin Birch Dairy in Schenectady, New York. In Brown's eyes, the cows on the farm aren't just workers. They're the boss. They're the queen of the barn. Brown, a co-owner at Twin Birch, is outspoken on the importance of sustainability in his operation. The average dairy cow emits as much as 265 pounds of methane, a potent climate warming gas, each year. Brown says Twin Birch has worked hard to cut its planet warming emissions through a number of environmentally sound choices. Ruminants are the solution, not the problem, to climate change, he said. Wearing a weathered hoodie and a hat promoting a brand of cow medicine, Brown was spending a windy Friday morning artificially inseminating some of the farm's massive Jerseys and Holsteins. He stepped over an electric manure scraper used to clean the animal's barn. The electric scraper means the dairy doesn't have to use a fuel-burning machine for that particular job. Twin Birch also recycles manure for use on crops, cools its milk with water that gets recirculated for cows to drink, and grows most of its own feed. Despite all of that, the farm has no desire to pursue a U.S. Department of Agriculture organic certification, Brown said. Doing so would add costs and require the farm to forego technology that makes the dairy business and ultimately the customer's jug of milk more affordable. He raises a question many farmers have been asking. Is organic farming just a word? An increasing number of American farmers think so. America's certified organic acreage fell almost 11% between 2019 and 2021. Numerous farmers who implement sustainable practices told the AP that they have stayed away from the certification because it's costly, doesn't do enough to combat climate change, and appears to be losing cachet in the marketplace. Converting an existing farm from conventional to organic agriculture can cost tens of thousands of dollars and add labor costs. The rules governing the National Organic Program were published in 2000, and in the years after, organic farming boomed to eventually reach more than 5 million acres, but that has declined in recent years. Any downward trend is significant, as organic farms make up less than 1% of the country's total acreages, and organic sales are typically only a tiny share of the nationwide total. Shannon Ratcliffe, a farmer and co-owner of organically certified Shannon Brook Farms in Watkins Glen, New York, attributes the decline to a 2018 fraud case in Iowa involving a farmer selling grain mislabeled as certified organic. The whole thing went crazy. Work requirements for farmers ramped up and inspection levels were higher, she said. It's also just a tough business. Her co-owner, Walter Adam, also thinks younger generations' interest in farming of any kind is declining. It takes 6 months to learn everything. We can't find anybody as willing to work on the farm. Adam drives to Manhattan each week to sell their meat and eggs at markets and spends Sunday mornings helping Ratcliffe with business at the Brighton Farmers Market in Brighton, New York. Frank Mittlehorner, a professor in animal science in the College of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences at the University of California, Davis, said lack of flexibility and efficiency are driving farmers away from organic in an era of rising prices for farmers. He said organic standards need to be overhauled, or the marketplace risks organic going away completely. John Bolton, owner of Bolton Farms in Hilton, New York, said he has some reservations about organic certification, but he's pursuing it for his hydroponic farm, which grows produce in nutrient-rich water instead of soil. Bolton doesn't use pesticides. On a chilly day this spring, he was at his greenhouse unloading 1,500 ladybugs to do the work of eliminating the operation's aphids. It's the kind of practice organic farms use to earn the certification. He said his operations aren't immune to the dangers posed by climate change. Abnormally hot days affect their greenhouse, he said. It's devastating to not only the people, but the plants. But Bolton described the organic certification as an economically and environmentally beneficial thing to his farm. Getting the certification will carry an expense, but he is confident it will be worth the price. It helps with sales, and you feel good about it. You're doing the right practices, Bolton said. And with that, we conclude the reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, May 13th, 2025. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with Part 2.